An artist's conception of the spacecraft is shown here. It shows the three triangular panels opened up with solar panels on them, the ramps for getting the rover off, the central electronics box with effectively a spark station inside, programmable in C, a lollipop-shaped high-gain antenna capable of up to 10 kilobits per second direct Earth return link, a imager that pops up from about knee height up to about my height, really good geology height to be above the surface, and it has two eyes just like me, and it can look all the way around up and down just like me. It has a low-gain antenna. It has a wind station or a meteorology mast for measuring the weather, and the real key of the payload is our one-foot rover called Sojourner. And you should think of this little rover as a one-foot geologist. It's just a little smaller version of me, and its job is to go out and look at rocks. And you say, why do you want to look at rocks? They're dull, boring things. You're trying to get them out of your garden. You hate them. Well, you're wrong, because rocks are amazingly exciting things to a geologist, because geologists can look at that rock and they can identify the minerals in it, and they can tell you uniquely how that rock formed. And even more importantly, they can tell you the environment in which that rock formed. Think of what a gift that geologists have. They can take this inanimate thing that you hate and they can read the history of the Earth in it. Or in this case, Mars. So this mission is a geology mission. And if you don't believe me, you can look at the Washington Post, the most influential newspaper in America, and they got it right. You can see this rover is very happy with a rock. We don't care about these guys. We want rocks. Where would you send such a mission, and what would you try to do with it? That could be focused, most likely. It shows a certain area on the surface of Mars. It shows right there is a 100 by 200 kilometer ellipse, and that's as accurately as you can target a spacecraft to Mars in the Pathfinder time frame. It's 100 kilometers by 200 kilometers, and it's going to land somewhere in that ellipse with no knowledge beforehand of where. And you can see we've placed this landing ellipse at the mouth of a giant catastrophic outflow channel named Aras Vallis. This feature is truly a catastrophic event. It's 100 kilometers wide and 2 to 3 kilometers deep, and it stretches for close to 1,000 kilometers and formed by analogy with similar features here on the Earth when roughly the volume of water that now sits within the Great Lakes of America eschewed out of the ground and carved this channel in a 2-week period, an event that man has never, ever seen. What's the rationale here? Well, look, this is ancient, heavily cratered terrain. The craters are back to back, and they represent some of the oldest terrain on Mars. It likely dates back from 3.9 to 3.5 billion years ago. And the idea is by landing at this mouth of this channel, we can look at a whole potpourri, a smorgasbord, a whole variety of rocks from the ancient heavily cratered terrain on Mars. What's so important about that terrain? Do you recall that extraordinary meteorite, Allen Hills 84001, the one with the little boogers in it that people thought maybe were life? Well, that came from terrain of this age, and there is tantalizing evidence from the Viking orbiter images taken 20 years ago. Again, ancient heavily cratered terrain, craters back to back on the surface, that liquid water may have been stable at this time on Mars. Here's a place in the heavily cratered terrain where I see an ancient lake bed. And I'll point it out to you. Here are all these little stream beds that all come down and end at a common elevation that I'm pointing out with this pointer. So this basin is 150 kilometers across, 100 kilometers wide, and water sat in it and then emptied out of a natural dam to the north and flowed out this way. No question, liquid water sat on the surface of Mars for some period of time. How long? I don't know. 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years? Long enough to produce this dry lake bed. What's so important about this? Liquid water is the absolute key requirement for life. If you want to have life, you have to have liquid water. Well, heck, think about it. For the price of a bad motion picture, we can go to Mars and address one of the most fundamental questions that we as scientists can address. Are we alone in the universe? Will life form anywhere that liquid water is stable? Or do you need some 1 in a trillion chance possibility? Do you need some divine intervention? What else do you need? Will it happen anywhere that liquid water is stable? Well, here it is. It's our neighboring planet in the solar system, and liquid water may have been stable. Well, you should go to Mars and find out if life developed there. If it did, what happened to it? If it didn't, why not? All for the price of a bad motion picture. This is as high a resolution as images of the landing site that we had prior to landing. Again, you can see this large football, the landing ellipse, 100 kilometers by 200 kilometers. You can see the effects of this catastrophic release of water, these large streamlined islands, 10 kilometers across, 40 kilometers wide. You can see a lot of these streamlined features attesting to the erosive capability of this water. I interpreted this fairly smooth and flat surface as being a depositional plane of material deposited by this catastrophic flood as it carved through and deposited the water in the basin out at the mouth of the channel. Now, the smallest thing that you can see on this image, these little bumps, are about the size of a football stadium. They're 40 meter per pixel resolution images. And the engineers came to me and said, we want a nice, smooth, flat place, and we don't want many rocks the size of this podium. What can you do for me? And I said, sure, no problem. I'll just look at this image, and I'll see lots of rocks about a meter in size. Not. How do you do that? How do you look at a 40 meter per pixel image and decide whether or not it's too rocky, whether it's safe for your landing system? What kind of other tools do you use? And we bounced radar waves from the Earth off of this surface to interpret the roughness and the elevation. We looked at thermal inertia data. We looked at color data. We looked at everything we could. We even went to a location on the Earth that was analogous to this location to evaluate the surface properties. And we made 3 broad predictions prior to landing. 1, it would be safe for our landing system. 2, it would be trafficable for the rover. And 3, it would have less dust than Viking 1 or 2 sites. And we were extraordinarily correct on all 3 counts. The telemetry prior to landing, 1 day before, implied that we were going to come to rest somewhere in the southwest corner of this ellipse. We actually came to rest in this blue X shown right there. And the reason we know where we came to rest was by comparing the location of what we could see on the horizon. Behold, here's the first pictures from the surface of Mars, and look at these beautiful streamlined islands in the background. That told us where we had come to rest within a couple of hours. How? We looked at the highest resolution images, and we found the only twin peaks in the entire area. There they are, south and north twin peak. We landed about 1 kilometer to the east-northeast of that point. We've also identified North Knob, shown here poking above the surface. We've also seen Southeast Knob, a full 22 kilometers to the southeast, and Far Knob, a full 31 kilometers to the south, poking on the horizon. We, in fact, predicted the location of Big Crater, 2.2 kilometers to the south, prior to seeing it. For reference, Viking 1 took about a year to figure out where they landed, and it looks like they got it wrong. And Viking 2 has taken infinity. We never figured out where it went down. Here's, in fact, the Big Crater. You can see it poking above the horizon right there, as predicted by scientists prior to acquiring these images on Sol 1. And the Mars Global Surveyor Orbiter has taken pictures of roughly the location of the lander. There's the Twin Peaks, North Knob, Big Crater, and so on. Now, we had a bit of an airbag problem here. You can see this airbag is all fluffed up around the edge of the pedal. And the way this works is this is a spring-loaded device, a ramp that the rover uses to get off of the lander. And this is a spring-loaded device. When you break these couplings, this thing unfurls violently and would come back and hurt our one-foot geologist. And you must always remember you never, ever want to hurt a geologist. So this was totally unacceptable. We had to lift this pedal up to 45 degrees. We had to retract the airbags further before unfurling these ramps, which we did on the end of Sol 1. We still were a little concerned about the airbags here. The ramps down to the surface, we were ready to go. And lo and behold, we got our main payload off on the surface of Mars on Sol 2. Now, we were pretty happy scientists at this point, and not just because we got our payload on Mars, but also because we learned a lot just by looking at this image. And you see this and you say, well, I don't see that at all. And you're just not looking carefully enough, because if you look at the wheels, you see these individual little cleats are on the wheel. And when you look at the pattern that they've left in the soil, you see each individual cleat is perfectly preserved in this material. Well, that's extraordinary. That tells you this material is not gravel. It tells you this material has to be very fine-grained and very compressible. And there's only one kind of material we know that could produce this pattern, and it likely has the constituency of kitchen flour. It's extremely fine-grained, probably micron in size, to produce this pattern. In addition, we rolled over this little 1 centimeter size pebble, and it's still there. In reference, Viking 1 or 2 and 2 had arms that went out and picked up about 10 of these pebbles, or what looked like these pebbles, and every time that arm picked them up, those little pebbles crumbled. They really weren't rocks. They were clods of material loosely bound. Well, heck, that's a rock. I know it. We rolled right over it. Well, the rover did have trouble at time. Here we are perched on the end of a wedge. But we never really got stuck horribly. And in the first, in the 100 days of the mission, this is the full panorama looking from the lander out to the horizon. Shown in white is the path that the rover took. And we traversed about 100 meters in about 90 days at the blistering pace of 1 meter per day. And we did get to the prime science interest, the so-called rock garden, the area here. Now, I believe that this surface that you see bears unmistakable evidence of the catastrophic flood that tore through this region between 3.9 and 1.8 billion years ago. And the best way for me to prove it to you is for all of you to put on your field boots and strap on your red-blue glasses, and let's take a little hike on Mars. Blue lens on the right. It will probably take your eyes a minute or two to equilibrate to looking through the glasses, but you should start seeing that this is not a flat place on Mars. Yes? No? A little bit? Maybe? Kind of? Sort of? Anybody see? Okay, there's Wedge, that's sticking out of the ground. There's Chimp. And now you see a subtle trough that extends right through here, a ridge there, a trough, a ridge trough. In fact, this is corrugated topography all the way back to the horizon. There's Far Knob, a full 30 kilometers to the south. Well, let's just take a little hike on Mars. Let's look around, see what we see. Looking off to the rock garden, we can see the forward ramp is poking out like a diving board. There's the airbags and the lander pedal, and you see this rocky surface. There's Wedge, that's Chimp, and this is the area called the rock garden, and this is the area called the bookshelf, because it has three rocks that look like they're imbricated or stacked together. In higher resolution here, you can see them a little bit better. There's Shark with its dorsal fin. You can see Half Dome poking out. There's Moe and Stimpy, and this is Flat Top. And now you see that these rocks form a ridge, and right behind it is a little trough. And then you see a ridge here and a trough, and ridge trough topography all the way to the back. Well, how did this get this way? A closer up at the rock garden shows these rocks are physically touching. They're stacked together and imbricated as if you were to take three books on a bookshelf and tilt them over. And the tilt or direction of tilt tells you the direction of flow, in this case from left to right, and is indicative of deposition in high velocity fluid flow from left to right. And I'll show you some more back there. But also look, this ridge is held up by these three rocks, and there's a knife edge ridge here and a trough right behind it. It looks like the ridges are held up by rocks and troughs don't seem to have them. You can also see the bright tops of flat top. That's likely atmospheric dust that has filtered out and fallen down onto the surface of some of these rocks. A more imbricated rock shown here, stacked up, touching, indicative of a high velocity fluid flow from left to right, as if you were to get in a catastrophic flood deposit. Again, the ridges are held up by the big rocks and the troughs are not. My interpretation of this, as is common in catastrophic flood deposits, is that the high velocity flow deposits these big rocks, and then you have 100 meters of water sitting around, and it has to drain away. And it preferentially takes away the fines, but it can't move these big guys. So the troughs could be late-stage drainage features, leaving behind the ridges that are held up by the rocks. Again, that subtle trough in a northeast fashion draining off this way, a ridge here held up by big rocks, trough, a ridge, knife-edge ridge, right on the edge of these streamlined islands. Again, the streamlining and the shape, as you would expect for large velocity flow that is streamlining them during the flooding event. A closer up shows that ridge event here, this ridge with the a trough or moat around the streamlined island. You can see how smooth it is. You can see almost horizontal layers on South Twin Peak that could be down-cutting events during the flood. Could be layers in the rock, in the material there as well. When you look even closer, you can almost identify individual blocks that look like they've been left stranded by the down-cutting events of the flood. Again, knife edge here, big trough as the water streamlined around these obstacles. Perch rocks are quite common. This one's pretty big, probably over a meter high and across, and in some cases have moats around them. This is an extremely rocky surface. Up to 20% of the surface, even some places 26%, is covered by rocks. They're all angular and sharp, and as I said, we have one of the most robust landing systems ever designed because we bounce 15 to 20 times on this gnarly surface without a single puncture in the airbags. Again, other areas less rocky, maybe 12 to 15% here. Subtle troughs draining off here. Again, angular rocks, aeolian features likely in a couple of places. So you can see this is not a flat place, and isn't this fun? Yeah, it is. There's your rover. That's your little microwave oven sitting on Mars. You can see this wind tail, this aeolian feature behind it. That's Barnacle Bill, a little moat behind it, maybe even a moat around Yogi, and we're about to spin around and get the composition of this. Fine scale patterns in the soil could be aeolian or wind-blown material. A close-up of Yogi. This is a close rock. It's about a meter across and a meter high. It's pretty big. In case you weren't sure why we named him Yogi, there's his nose and his eyes and his ears. So there's definitely bears on Mars, no question about it. A close-up here shows, in fact, these tabular rocks. I would call them sub-rounded, quite indicative of deposition by catastrophic floods. Again, subtle troughs. This rock's named Couch. You can see it's optimally oriented for sports viewing on the telly. This area, this is Calvin and that's Hobb. And you can see these are kind of rascally little rocks. And so we had to go around them with the rover off in this direction. again, fine scale wind pattern, and in some cases, what looked like spherically rounded particles, which was a bit of a surprise, and I'll come back to that later. Looking off to the north, this is Mini Matterhorn here. The airbags actually got stuck on this rock as they were retracting. The whole lander tilted to about 45 degrees as the airbags were retracted before falling over. They actually got snagged on the snout there. You can see this disturbed region where it looks like the lander may have sat prior to rolling over, and angular rocks with subtle troughs all the way into the background, airbags and lander pedal. Another area showing a line of rocks, a subtle trough, Aeolian features here, looking back, again, ridge trough topography. And a close-up of the top of the meteorology mast shows one of the cone shapes, wind socks, and the wind sensor on top of the mast, temperatures at three heights, subtle troughs, again, a rocky region on Mars. That's it for the glasses, but keep them handy because we're going to poke our face against some rocks a little bit later.